Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. We're following one of the most consequential decisions President Trump has made in his 3 years in office. Qassem Soleimani, the most powerful military commander in Iran, was killed last night by a U.S. strike in Iraq. According to the Pentagon, he was planning an attack on Americans across the region. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Fox and Friends this morning.
The risk of doing nothing was enormous, enormous in the short term in terms of the imminent attack that Qassem Soleimani was plotting, but also highly risky. Doing nothing in this region shows weakness.
Iranian leaders have vowed harsh retaliation and revenge. Meanwhile, politicians in Washington are bracing for the possibility of another war in Iraq and Iran. Let's bring in Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. And Beth Fooey, senior political director at NBC and MSNBC. Hi, Beth. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
And Beth, let's start with you. Some members of Congress, mostly Democrats, say they were not briefed ahead of this strike. Here's Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, who was speaking with Morning Edition earlier today, talking about the president's justification for authorizing the airstrike.
He has the ability to prevent imminent attack against the United States without coming to Congress. I think we need to see the facts that that is, in fact, true. He does not have any other standing authorization to take out a strike against a country that we have not declared war against.
Beth, Democrats are making the argument that they have not authorized this. They weren't consulted. What are you hearing on Capitol Hill?
Right. I mean, it's another norm-busting aspect of this presidency is he, you know, has made the decision to go ahead and do this without the traditional briefing of, you know, the so-called Gang of Eight, those House and Senate leaders of both parties, plus the chairs of the intelligence committees. We know that Nancy Pelosi put out that statement last night saying she'd been informed and had a conversation with the DOD Secretary Mike Esper pretty much while the raid was unfolding. So you're going to hear a lot of that from congressional Democrats and maybe even some Republicans that at least Congress at minimum needs to be briefed, if not needs to actually authorize this kind of military action each time. It's been an ongoing conversation really for many years,
right,
since the Bush administration about how much Congress needs to be involved in these decisions that, as you heard Mike Pompeo say, really needed to be made imminently. That is going to continue to be discussed as this goes forward. And members of Congress are certainly saying, absent having been informed in advance, we'd like to know what the plan is now,
right,
and going forward strategically.
Scott, what about that? Presidents from both parties have not gone to Congress before these airstrikes. Obama didn't do it before he took out bin Laden. What's different about this, if anything?
I'm not sure there's anything different. I think what may be different is that this all comes against the backdrop of impeachment and relationships between President Trump and top congressional leaders who he normally would have informed, including Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff, who led the impeachment investigation. Those two would have been part of this Gang of Eight that Beth mentioned that would have normally gotten a briefing. But in recent months, President Trump has not briefed Congress, including last October, last fall, when the president and the DOD conducted an airstrike against an ISIS leader, al-Baghdadi, and killed him. And so this is not, it is unusual that this would come right after the new year and right as we're preparing to get into this Senate impeachment fight. But as you mentioned before, yeah, past presidents have struggled with this this idea of notifying Congress and providing, a heads up to Congress before these types of attacks.
Scott, I want to get to the implications of the impeachment trial in just a moment. But Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said he actually was briefed earlier this week. He tweeted today, "We killed the most powerful man in Tehran short of Ayatollah. This was not an act of revenge for what he had done in the past. This was a preemptive defensive strike planned to take out the organizer of attacks yet to come." Both you and Beth have talked about those in support, those not in support. Are Republicans on Capitol Hill united behind the president in this?
Yeah, so far we are seeing very positive, glowing comments from Republicans praising the president for taking decisive action. And, you know, I spoke to Mark Meadows, the one of President Trump's congressional allies, earlier today, and he was echoing some of what Lindsey Graham has said as well, that there was an imminent threat against Americans, both military personnel as well as people perhaps stationed at embassies. And so that the president had no choice but to act quickly and decisively and take this action before taking steps to notify, you know, all the relevant members of Congress. And so, you know, we are seeing, you know, we're seeing Republicans rally behind the president, and they've done so in the past and they continue to do so now.
Beth, Scott brought up the impeachment trial. What about the optics of a possible war with Iran during this impeachment trial? We remember during his impeachment, Republicans accused President Clinton of using airstrikes in Iraq as a way that was sort of a diversionary tactic.
Right. It's amazing how history repeats itself in some ways. Yeah. I mean, not only do we have this confluence of impeachment and military action, as we did back in 1998, but throw in the mix this 2020 campaign, where the Democrats are very close to starting the primary process, the primary caucus process, where a nominee will be selected to run against President Trump. So that's all playing out in the middle of all this as well. It's going to be a very strange month of January, as we can just a week ago, we were all just waiting to find out when the articles of impeachment would be sent over to the Senate and what the Senate trial would look like. And now we're going to have an overlay of, you know, potential military action, potential threat to American targets, and the presidential campaign being waged out in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Well, Beth, does this potential conflict with Iran interfere with the impeachment trial and push it back even further?
You know, that's a decision that Mitch McConnell will make, and hopefully we'll know something about that soon. But it will certainly cast a shadow on over this and complicate matters.
You know, there's also the other thing. I mean, when you talk about the 2020 presidential election, both Beth and Scott, NPR is reporting that the rest of the 82nd Airborne Brigade could be sent over in the next 28 to 48 hours, meaning a total of 3,200 troops. How will this resonate on the campaign trail? We know that wartime presidents are usually reelected. I'll start with you, Scott.
Well, I think the concern from a lot of Democrats at this point is that, you know, this move against Soleimani could exacerbate the situation and lead to retaliatory attacks against United States targets abroad. And so, you know, if that were to happen, if we were to see other terrorist attacks against the United States, that could rally the country and certainly the Congress around this president, sort of like we saw after 9/11. And so it remains to be seen how this will all play out. I think a lot of Democrats are concerned that this has been a step too far, and that the president has not fully thought about the consequences of what will happen next.
Beth, what's your read on the campaign finance numbers that have been coming out this week? Today we learned that Elizabeth Warren is the only top-tier Democrat who raised less in the fourth quarter than in the third. She raised $21.2 million. Yesterday, we saw that Joe Biden raised less than Pete Buttigieg, and Bernie Sanders brought in way more than any other Democrat. What does all of this tell you?
Well, it tells us two things. Well, it tells us more than two, but let's talk about two. One, that Bernie Sanders' support is deep and enduring and, frankly, surprising, I think, to a lot of Democrats who just sort of, you know, continue to believe that he's sort of in a category of his own. And while popular with the very sort of left-leaning part of the party, he doesn't necessarily have a path to the nomination. The numbers that we're seeing from Senator Sanders show that he clearly does. He clearly has a path at least to stay in the race for quite some time, given these numbers and given the fact that they dwarf others in the field, including Joe Biden, the presumptive frontrunner at this point. But the other thing I would say, Peter, is we're seeing all of these candidates, really all these Democrats, really raking in massive amounts of money if you look at it collectively.
Mm-hmm.
The Democratic the folks willing to give money to Democrats running for president is quite substantial, and the numbers are quite huge once added up all together. So the fact that, yes, President Trump also is raising tons of money,
a lot.
is certainly the case. But we're also seeing that, you know, once a nominee is chosen, Democrats are more than willing to be writing checks at this point.
Scott, you take the Donald Trump numbers, because he and the Republican National Committee have raised almost $500 million this year.
Yeah, an astronomical figure. And, you know, typically we will see incumbent presidents be able to rake in the dough like Donald Trump and his team have done. They also have spent a lot of, you know, time fundraising and courting donors and reaching out and building up that apparatus that necessarily wasn't there during the 2016 campaign, where it was pretty much a one-man show. Now, Donald Trump and the Republican National Committee have merged. They are one. And so that's a big part, I think, of why you're seeing President Trump be able to pull in these big numbers, because he now has the infrastructure behind him.
There's lots to watch. President Trump will be holding a rally in Milwaukee the same night as Democratic candidates will be debating in Iowa. That's Scott Wong. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill. And Beth Fooey is a senior political director at NBC and MSNBC. Thank you both for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Millions of American workers got a raise this week when 21 states and even more cities and counties raised the minimum wage. In Seattle, workers now get at least $16.39 an hour. In New Mexico, the minimum wage went up 20% to $9 an hour. This was the largest number of local governments to ever raise the wage floor all at once, and you can credit the Fight for 15 movement that got started back in 2012. Yannette Lathrop is a policy analyst at the National Employment Law Project, and she joins us now. Yannette, welcome.
Thank you.
Is there a way to quantify how these raises will change people's lives?
Obviously, there will be a number of workers who will be affected, and they will get they will be receiving increases from a couple hundred dollars all the way to $16 or more per year. The Economic Policy Institute has estimated that about 8 million workers will benefit at the beginning of the year from these increases.
And what about the local economy in general? I mean, it'll help the workers, but what about everybody else? Will it?
It will. Minimum wage increases not only benefit workers, but they also benefit small businesses specifically, but also businesses in general. Minimum wage workers are not only workers, but they are also consumers. So that is going to really have an effect in the local economy, especially as these increases allow these workers to purchase more.
But I know you're aware of the critics who will say that higher wages drive up prices for everybody. They lead to layoffs, and it also leaves workers who have less experience or less education out of the workforce altogether. I mean, what do you say to that? And have we seen that happen in places where the minimum wage has gone up?
Well, we haven't really seen the minimum wage having an effect on employment. The bulk of the research on the minimum wage shows that minimum wage increases actually do have the positive effect on workers' earnings, but they really don't have much of an effect either way, positive or negative, on employment. And inflation is going up whether or not the minimum wage really is increased. Prices will go up. That's just a fact. And that takes place year after year.
We're talking about states, but of course, bigger picture, federally speaking, minimum wage hasn't budged in over a decade. It's still $7.25 an hour, which means if you don't live in one of these other states, that's what your minimum wage is. What's the latest on raising the federal minimum wage? I know Congress tried to pass this earlier in the year, but it didn't make it out of the Senate.
In the House, the minimum wage, the Raise the Wage Act passed by bipartisan support, including three Republicans. And in the Senate, unfortunately, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and the Senate Chair Committee, Lamar Alexander, have refused to bring the bill to the floor. This bill is really popular around the country. We have seen polls that show that about two-thirds of voters support a $15 minimum wage increase. We just need to convince the Senate leadership to bring it to the vote.
But does it really make sense to raise wages to $15 an hour in every place across the country? Because, you know, the cost of living, for example, in a place like Wyoming is far different than the cost of living in, say, Massachusetts, where I am now.
That is correct. The cost of living can vary across the country, but especially in places like Wyoming, as you mentioned, in other low-cost states and localities, a $15 minimum wage will actually be even more beneficial because at least there, a $15 minimum wage will be more of a living wage than in a place like Massachusetts or New York or Washington, D.C. or San Francisco, where the cost of living are just that much more. And a $15 minimum wage may not cover as much.
I notice that if you're in a place like Pennsylvania, which is a big populous state, the minimum wage is still tied to the federal rate, $7.25 an hour. What is life like for someone who's making that amount in a city like Pittsburgh or Philadelphia?
People have to make really difficult choices. They can pay rent on time if they are able to, but they may not be able to afford other necessities such as healthcare, medicine, shoes for their kids. They may have to buy processed foods or may not be able to actually buy enough food for themselves or their families. That just cannot continue to go on.
That's Yannette Lathrop. She is a researcher and policy analyst at the National Employment Law Project. Yannette, thank you.
Thank you.
Another story we're tracking at the start of the year is the state of President Trump's promised border wall. He said that 500 miles would get built before November's presidential election. In the new spending bill signed on December 20th, Democrats and Republicans agreed to set aside $1.4 billion to help reach that goal, although it's far less than the nearly $9 billion the president had originally requested. And now the fight over the border wall is entering a new phase as the government begins the process of seizing the land it needs through eminent domain. Elizabeth Findell of The Wall Street Journal has the latest, and she joins us now from Houston. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And help me understand just how much new border wall has the Trump administration built?
Well, the last numbers that I saw was that they had built a little over 90 miles, but most of that has been replacing already existing border fencing on federal land out in California and Arizona. As far as, you know, new wall where wall didn't exist before, they have broken ground on a short stretch in Texas, south of the city of Donna in the Rio Grande Valley. And they're expecting that to be about 8 miles long. And so far they have maybe a couple hundred feet.
8 miles long, and the price tag that we see on that section is $167 million. So it's not cheap. What do people down there think of that new stretch of wall?
Well, people who live along the border oppose the border wall in greater numbers than people in Texas overall. The state overall is split about 50-50 in whether people support the wall, but a majority of people who live along the border itself oppose it. So I think there's some frustration, some sense that it's just, you know, a waste of money and won't do much. And of course, some people support it because they believe it'll make it easier for Border Patrol to do their job.
Right. I know you've also been reporting on some of the environmental concerns that building the wall along the river there in the Rio Grande Valley could lead to flooding, and it could also affect the actual legal border between Mexico and the United States. Tell me more about that and if it's slowing the work down.
Well, what you're talking about is an effort that has begun by some people to build a stretch of private border wall. So it's separate from the government's effort. And when the federal government builds border wall, at least in South Texas, they build it on levees that are maybe half a mile to a mile north of the river because you don't want to put a big wall through the middle of a floodplain. But the folks who are building private border wall right now in South Texas, which is a company called Fisher Industries, they're building it directly on the river, and they've clear-cut about 3 miles of natural brush and actually plowed about a 3 to 4 foot vertical riverbank into a beach. And so the federal government sued them and obtained a temporary injunction to halt them from continuing work because there are serious flood control concerns associated with messing with the riverbank like that, as well as if the river moves, then the border moves. And so under a treaty the United States has with Mexico, neither country is allowed to mess with the riverbank.
Wow. So questions about whether or not a private border wall is legal. And that would also explain and this irony, I guess, where on the one hand you have, in this case, the U.S. Attorney's Office suing to stop this process, and on the other hand,
yes,
making the effort to start taking private land through eminent domain to build this wall in other areas of the Rio Grande,
yes,
Valley.
That's correct. And I should note that the company that's building the private border wall, Fisher Industries, is the same company that has gotten about a $400 million contract to build government border wall and is now under investigation involving that contract.
Now, on the issue of eminent domain and the federal government trying to take private land to build some of these new stretches of wall, where do we stand on that? And do these landowners have a chance at all to thwart the government here?
Well, the answer to that is that not really. They don't have much of a chance in court, landowners, to beat the government. However, they may have a chance to increase somewhat the compensation that they're offered, or even to just slow the process down enough so that things end up changing politically. And in South Texas, that's still at its earliest phases. They're still mostly in the surveying phase. And so you have to first sue someone in federal court for the right to survey their property. And then after you've done that, then assuming they don't want to sell you the property, you have to sue them again to forcibly take it.
So it sounds like the takeaway is that the president's promise to build these 500 miles of wall along the border is a little bit harder to pull off than he might have expected. I mean, what would need to happen in order for that to come true by the time the next election rolls around?
Well, they are moving quickly at this point, and we have heard some criticism from some sort of anti-border wall groups in that area that this stretch they've started building is, you know, just to show that they're doing something. But they, yeah, to get something built, they'll need to either find more landowners who are willing to sell them the property voluntarily, or they'll have to just wait out the court process, which is typically takes longer than a few months.
That's Elizabeth Findell. She is in Houston covering the construction of the wall along the U.S.-Mexico border for the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
As tensions with Iran continue to escalate, all eyes are on the Strait of Hormuz. Nearly 30 million barrels of oil go through the narrow strait each day. That's double the entire oil production of the United States. And as Iran threatens to retaliate for the killing of top General Qassem Soleimani, analysts are predicting that Iran may attack oil tankers as it's done before, leading to a potential surge in prices. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, we're seeing oil prices are up about 4% today following this U.S. attack. Of course, we're all worried about human casualties, but how worried should people be about the potential disruption to oil today?
Well, oil's Iran's biggest weapon as it relates to the rest of the world. It can wage what we would call an asymmetric war. You wouldn't see a war with the United States in a traditional sense because the United States has overwhelming power. But Iran's got proxies all over the region, many of which are funded by oil. And as you mentioned, a lot of oil goes through the Strait of Hormuz, which at its closest point, its narrowest point is about 21 miles. And when you think there's two channels, right, one goes out of the Persian Gulf and one goes into it, that's very, very narrow. And using traditional weapons, the Iranians can either target a tanker or mine the strait, which they've said they're going to do. So 4% is not a massive rise in the price of oil. Yeah. It's not normal, but it indicates that the world is not fully alarmed yet. It is somewhat alarmed that this could lead to more escalation.
Also wondering about countries like China and India. 80% of the crude oil that goes through the strait passes through that strait goes through to Asia. If Iran does disrupt shipments there as it did this summer, how might Asia actually be affected?
So that's a tricky one because those Asian countries actually have always bought oil from Iran, even when it was under embargo. So Iran's not looking to upset its best clients. But at the moment, Iran has limited options. Its economy is suffering. Qasem Soleimani by some accounts, may have been the second most powerful person in Iran, probably for the last 20 years. So this is very, very, very serious for Iran. The United States sometimes has a drone attack and takes some leader out of some group, and it's, you know, amongst people who think about these things a lot, it's important. This is actually a big deal. So I think we can expect some response from Iran, but I'm sure they are all sitting around in Tehran calculating what the response can be that doesn't actually hurt Iran more.
Yeah, Iran is promising retaliation. They're in a frail position. Inflation is around 36%.
Yeah.
We also know there was a 50% gas hike in Iran. They implemented after the tamp down of domestic demand. But I want to talk with the little bit of time I have with you about Iraq for a moment. We're seeing videos circulating on social media that Iraqis are celebrating the death of Soleimani today. Why are they celebrating?
Well, because Soleimani was the representative, or the military representative of Iran. Iraq is a mostly Shiite country. Iran is sort of the Vatican for Shiite Muslims. So a lot of the Shiites are very, very upset about this. There are Sunnis all through Iraq, which is why ISIS was actually formed, to protect the Sunnis in Iraq. They are celebrating. So watching video of people celebrating or not celebrating today needs to come with a lot of context. There are definitely some people in Iraq who are happy with Qasem Soleimani's death. There are probably a lot more who are unhappy about it. Iraq is one of those places where Shiites, Sunni tensions loom large, and they're larger today than they've been in a long time.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thank you.
My pleasure.
More reaction now to our top story. The U.S. airstrike that killed a powerful Iranian general at Baghdad's international airport early today. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told CNN that President Trump ordered the strike on Qasem Soleimani.
The American people should know the President Trump's decision to remove Qasem Soleimani from the battlefield saved American lives. There's no doubt about that. He was actively plotting in the region to take actions, a big action as he described it, that would have put dozens, if not hundreds, of American lives at risk.
Meanwhile, Iran is promising revenge. Here's Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif speaking to the BBC through an interpreter.
The U.S. action is without a doubt an act of state-sponsored terrorism and a violation of Iraq's sovereignty.
Jim Walsh is here with us now. He is here now, security analyst and with MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, it's good to see you on this very important day.
Good to see you, Peter.
Mike Pompeo says the world is safer today, is it?
Not if this tips us towards war. I mean, the U.S. just assassinated a senior military official of a foreign government. Our story does not add up, of imminent attack does not add up. If someone did that to us, if someone assassinated, you know, the head of CENTCOM or PAYCOM, we'd consider that an act of war. And it's interesting, the language you just quoted from Pompeo, removing Soleimani from the battlefield, as if we're already at war. Congress has not authorized a war. We are not fighting a full-blown war, but that's where we may go with this, and that would make it more dangerous, not less dangerous.
He has been on the radar of the U.S. military for many years now. In fact, I have seen somebody say that he was essentially like killing the vice president of the United States, so a very big deal. But he was also incredibly powerful, coordinating a sphere of influence across the region in places like Syria, Lebanon, in Yemen. Just remind us who this man was and how important he was.
So he's a general head of the Quds Force. Now, on the in Iran's army, Revolutionary Guard, it's mostly aimed at domestic stability. So most of the IRGC is really focused on the Iranian homeland. The Quds Force is rather oriented outside of Iran, beyond Iran's borders. So that means, you know, the Middle East as we know it. And he certainly built a certain reputation for himself. You know, you'd see posters of him in Lebanon and that sort of thing. I mean, the question today among some analysts is, have we created a new martyr? Because while he was hated by some, he was loved by others.
He was undoubtedly responsible for American deaths, right? I mean, is there
no
any
doubt
debate
about it? Particularly 2007, 2008, when we were, you know, 2006, that area when we were in Iraq. No doubt that Iran put agents in that attacked U.S. forces.
So is that a good reason for the strike?
Justified. Well, I mean, it's not 2007. It's 2020. The excuse we're giving for it, as I said, doesn't add up. It says Pompeo says, well, we were facing an imminent strike. And under international law, if someone's just about to pop you, you are able to go in legally and take them out.
Wasn't that his job, though, all along? I mean, it was always his job to find these opportunities.
I would say it doesn't add up for this reason. If you're about to prevent, and again, the key word here is imminent attack, you would attack the unit that would be executing the assault. You wouldn't attack the decision maker who had made the decision. That doesn't do anything to stop the attack. If you have intel about a particular attack, then you go after the attackers. In fact, Pompeo's own language, again, that in that quote, he said, well, you know, he may have been planning an attack that could have killed dozens or hundreds. In other words, he doesn't know.
Right.
This is completely vague and, you know, deeply, if not from a – it's certainly questionable from a policy standpoint. It may be illegal.
Stanley McChrystal, the former general, wrote in Foreign Policy magazine just last year that he had had the chance back in 2007 to take out Soleimani, but he decided against it because of fear, essentially, of what the reaction would be from the Iranians. That fear hasn't necessarily gone away.
No, and that's been, you know, throughout the U.S. military, particularly CENTCOM, up until this last commander. I knew Secretary Mattis when he was head of CENTCOM, and I knew his successor. And then he was replaced up until this most recent head of CENTCOM. It was generally the view of the military that it was a bad idea to label the IRGC, a government organization, terrorist group, and to go after and assassinate senior members because we only have 5,000 troops in Iraq. Now they're all exposed. Those whatever we have in Syria, they're all exposed. And so we're the ones who are vulnerable, not Iran, in that situation.
Lay that out. What are the possible options that Iran could take here in retaliation?
Well, I think Iran will there was an announcement just before I came on air that they've decided what they're going to do. I don't know if that's true or not. I think they'll take their time. They'll choose the moment and the place where they seek their revenge. It could be lots of small things, attacks on U.S. forces. It could be going after a senior U.S. official. But I think in the main, they still want to stay below a line that leads to all-out war, but they cannot let this go unanswered. Mm-hmm. There's no country on earth that would just turn the other cheek in the face of this assault.
What about the other country involved here? Iraq? Not as powerful by any stretch of the imagination. Caught in the middle. What's Iran going to ask of Iraq?
It certainly complicates domestic politics in Iraq at a time when it is already in crisis. As you know, the prime minister resigned because of the social protests demanding reform.
Still in office, though.
Yes, but he's essentially a non-player. I noted this morning that Grand Ayatollah Sistani, the senior cleric in Iraq, condemned the attack but asked for restraint. It puts Iraq in a terrible place, right? Iran has helped it to defeat ISIS, and the U.S. has helped it to defeat ISIS. So they have to maintain a bridge to both sides, and this just makes that more difficult.
Meanwhile, the question, of course, is what is the White House going to do, and are they prepared to respond coherently? Look at the change in the turnover that we've seen in this administration recently. Now on its fourth national security advisor, a fifth head of Homeland Security. There's talk even that Secretary Pompeo may be on the way out soon. Does that concern you?
Absolutely. You know, I was in here the other day talking to Robin on New Year's Day.
Yeah.
She asked me a question, well, what most concerns you? And I talked about India, Pakistan, I talked about China. We ended the segment. And then we kept chatting a little bit afterwards. And I said, you know, one thing I didn't mention was the broken U.S. national security process. We're the most powerful country in the world. If we screw things up, we can really do ourselves a lot of harm. And right now we have, as you point out, four national security advisors in 4 years. We purged all the Iran experts out of the National Security Council. And what are we getting? In the summer, President Trump decided not to send a missile strike because he wanted to use restraint. He said restraint was strength. Remember that? Mm-hmm. And that attack, what we were going to respond to, you know, was pretty significant. And then now we've swung in the opposite direction and taken what I think most analysts would consider very much a large escalatory attack. I think this is what happens when there are no adults in the room.
Well, who has his ear then? Who's he getting advice from?
You know, I don't know. I mean, the Secretary of Defense is not a national security expert and doesn't know anything about Iran. As I said, they purged the Iran experts out of the National Security Council. Certainly the current CENTCOM commander, General McKenzie, would have a large say. But this is not a normal process. And what's a little clue about that? it's pretty obvious there was little or no preparation or coordination. We're not ready for, you know, we carry out the attack and then we say, okay, everyone out of Iraq, mm-hmm. right? You know, there's like you're supposed to sort of pull that together at the last minute. We're just sort of bumbling from one extreme to the other extreme, back and forth without a strategy. I just think this is adding to the danger, not reducing it.
Well, and it does seem like something of a dangerous game of ping pong, where each side will be hitting the ball back harder with every swing, with every retaliation. How do you de-escalate a situation like that?
Well, that's the key question. I think we need to move to de-escalation. Now, Secretary Pompeo said yesterday, after the strike, he wants to de-escalate. You know, that's sort of like the kid who walks on the playground and pops someone in the mouth and says, no more fighting.
That seems very hard to do at this point.
And ironically, you'll remember that just a day ago, I think it was, the protesters who had, you know, I think it was mostly political theater if you look at the video, but who had, you know, roughed up the embassy guard tower, they all withdrew. They were asked by the militias to withdraw, and they withdrew. So that was sort of a sign of de-escalation. And now with that settled, bang, we're back up, you know, seven stages.
I guess you could safely say that any negotiations on the Iranian nuclear agreement are probably now out the window.
Oh,
any
my God.
Negotiations whatsoever.
Yeah,
for a
I mean,
while.
It's so ironic. You'll remember, so at the UN in September, President Trump tried to arrange a handshake with Rouhani. That is off the table for the foreseeable future.
Jim, I'm sure we'll have you back soon. Jim Walsh here now, security analyst. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
In California, a judge will soon decide whether a group of mothers will be able to stay in a vacant house they illegally took over late last year. Their story has become a major flashpoint in Oakland, where homelessness is at an all-time high and housing prices have soared. We're joined now by one of those mothers, Dominic Walker, co-founder of a group they formed called Moms for Housing. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dominique, let's first talk about what got you to this moment. You're an Oakland native who recently moved back with your kids, 14-month-old son and a 5-year-old daughter from Mississippi after fleeing a domestic violence situation. I read that you knew it would be challenging to find housing, but you had no idea just how difficult it would be. Tell us a little bit more about those challenges and what led you to squat in this home that you're in now.
Yes, it was really important for me to get back to my family here. Which was kind of odd because when I got back, they were so displaced everywhere in Antioch and Stockton and other places other than Oakland.
And
Oakland
those places are miles and miles away from Oakland.
Miles. So at first I was commuting all the way from Stockton to work in Oakland every single day, dropping the kids off in Berkeley and then working in Oakland. Then that situation didn't work out. Then I was in Antioch at a family member's house and we're in hotels.
So after going through that process, you decided that you would move into an abandoned home in West Oakland.
Yes, we had no choice. It was desperation. It was getting cold and it became a matter of what any mother would do for her children is to find shelter and make sure that they are safe. And this is the reality that we're faced with in Oakland.
There also happens to be more than 4,000 vacant buildings and homes in Oakland. A lot of people will say, well, hey, this is a simple way to help solve the problem. Just let the homeless people move into these vacant properties. But the fact is, what you're talking about is illegal. What is your response to that?
It should be illegal to have mothers and children sleeping on the street in winter, working moms that are going to work, trying to provide, and coming back to the street. That should be the only thing that should be criminalized in society is having people sleeping on the street when shelter and the right to shelter is a basic need.
You received an eviction notice from the management company which owns the house you're living in. It's called Wedgewood. You've taken this action to court to reverse your eviction. What else are you asking for?
We want speculators out of our city.
You call developers speculators?
Yes, we do. And we want them out of Oakland. These
What do you mean by that?
They come in and they buy up property and they sit on them to gain profit off of them. And they come in and they buy foreclosed homes to try to profit on somebody else's hardship. And we want them out.
You've started this group, Moms for Housing. Beyond your personal plight, what are you pushing for?
what's next for me and my family. We're going to continue to organize and fight for housing for all. This issue is not just a issue for us in Oakland. It's an issue all over the world. And we hope that this becomes a movement, a national movement for the right to housing, because it's a basic need. All of our basic needs are being commodified. And if we don't stop it now, we're going to have no future. Everything is connected.
That's Dominique Walker, co-founder of Moms for Housing, who was recently evicted from her home she was squatting in Oakland, California. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have with us now Sam Singer, spokesperson for Wedgewood Incorporated, the management company that owns the home Dominique currently lives in. Sam, let's start with the facts. There's no disputing that what Dominique Walker and the Moms for Housing is doing by squatting is against the law. But does she have a point about your business practices? Your company owns over 125 properties in Northern California and several more throughout the nation. And there have been complaints that these properties are vacant and dilapidated and eyesores for neighborhoods throughout the country. Can you explain why this is?
The reality is that Wedgewood is in the business of buying foreclosed homes where people have failed to make the payments, or for one reason or another, they're in distress. And in this particular business, time is money. So none of these homes are vacant. The home that the squatters took over in Oakland wasn't vacant. It had just been purchased by Wedgewood when these individuals broke in illegally and began to illegally occupy it.
You know, I'm sure your company, this was the last thing you wanted to be the center of, but your company has become the center of a larger conversation in Oakland about homelessness and high housing prices. Does this change in any way your practices or your relationship with the communities in which you're buying all of these vacant and foreclosed homes?
Absolutely not. What's really unfortunate here is a small group of activists have decided to take the law into their own hands. They've decided to steal someone else's property by breaking into it and by using force to remain into it, by saying that they won't leave without a fight. That's not a lawful, moral, or ethical way to change the homelessness issue.
That's Sam Singer with Wedgewood Incorporated. Sam, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
It's estimated that nearly half a billion animals have been killed in fires in Australia since September. We speak with an ecologist about how he came up with that number and how, in reality, the situation may be much worse as fires there continue to burn. That's next time on Here and Now.